Hi, and welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Good, a registered nutritional therapy practitioner and functional medicine practitioner. Join me as we explore thyroid, brain, and fatigue conditions with positivity. From Hashimoto's to multiple sclerosis, chronic fatigue to adrenal dysfunction, I've got you covered. With expert advice and tips to help you take action now and inspiring real patient stories from successful individuals who refuse to let their health hold them back. Start your journey to good health today. And don't forget to come and join the conversation on Instagram at good_health. That's G-O-O-D-E. Or visit my website at nicolegoodhealth.com to find out more. In today's episode, we're welcoming Lauren Windass onto the Good Health Podcast. Lauren is a renowned registered nutritionist. She's a naturopath. She's an author, and she's the co-founder of Ardere, a holistic well-being company specializing in private wellness and natural self-care products. Lauren runs a clinical practice, both online and in central London, which involves working with clients who suffer from chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME, or post-viral fatigue-related conditions. She also works with IBS and digestive concerns, as well as those struggling with their weight or poor relationships with food, such as disordered eating. Lauren is also qualified as a master practitioner in eating disorders and obesity with the National Center for Eating Disorders and is trained as an NLP. Lauren journeyed into the world of well-being and nutrition because of her own health problems at university with chronic fatigue syndrome and IBS, and this led her to support others who are struggling with this chronic illness. In today's episode, we're going to be deep diving into chronic fatigue syndrome. We're going to be talking about both of our journeys with chronic fatigue and also what you can do to support yourself if this is something that you are facing. Let's jump straight into today's episode. Okay, Lauren, welcome to the Good Health Podcast. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Nicole.
Yeah, so today we're going to be delving into the world of chronic fatigue, which I know is quite a passion area for both of us. We've both got personal history with it, and obviously you've got a lot of clinical work around, you've got the book out as well around chronic fatigue. So I know it's sort of a really big area for both of us. But let's start on the personal side, I guess. Let's talk about, you know, your journey with chronic fatigue and how that kind of sparked this interest in you and how it started everything, I guess.
Yeah. So it all kind of started for me back when I was 19. I just started my second year at Newcastle University. So I remember being kind of fresh as week of September time of moving into our second year. And so this was 2012, so just over 10 years ago now. And I remember basically just going back to uni and basically catching a viral infection and just almost that classic never been well since situation.
Yeah.
I remember just being like floored with the symptoms. Obviously, it was definitely kind of the most severe kind of infection I'd probably had, where, you know, you just kind of throwing your head over all that.
And yeah, all the soils and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Your head in like hot water and letting the steam and bless. And I just, yeah, it floored me. And I remember it was like, I think 3 or 4 weeks passed and I was still not really any better. So at that point, I kind of just decided to go along to the GP. I was interestingly given a course of antibiotics for a viral infection, which was interesting. But I was basically told, go back home to Yorkshire, which is where my parents live, go back home and rest. Take a couple of weeks just to rest up. And I basically took 3 weeks, obviously out of university, rested up. And then whilst I cleared the kind of acute viral symptoms, I just remember going back to uni thinking, okay, well, I've got rid of most of it, kind of the runny nose, the, you know, stuffy nose, et cetera. And then I just remember going back and I still don't feel quite right. And it was kind of that classic never been well since of turning up to lectures, feeling like I'm falling half asleep in class, then having to go back home to then obviously fall asleep to recover. I had severe brain fog, digestive issues, and I'd had IBS prior to this, but the symptoms got a lot worse and more pronounced. And then obviously the fatigue was kind of setting in, muscle and joint aches, feeling dizzy, hungover when I'd not touched a drop of alcohol. So kind of you name it, the symptoms, I had it. And I basically ended up kind of going to the doctors and, I mean, long story short, trying to find answers. And I couldn't actually really find a lot of answers through the NHS. And that's kind of what led me on my journey into kind of nutrition and complementary health and working with a team of nutritionists, functional medicine practitioners to then obviously really help to up level and almost put the piece, jigsaw puzzle pieces back together of what was actually going on with me. And so that sparked my interest. Luckily, I managed to get through my degree. So obviously with ME/CFS, it's a spectrum disorder. So it impacts people at various different degrees. But I would say I was mild to moderate. So whilst I was still suffering, it was very debilitating for me. I was, you know, was mobile. I was able to still go to some classes and things like that. And really kind of get by with extensions and whatnot and things like that. And that kind of helped me see through getting through the degree. And that's kind of then what really kind of sparked my interest to then train as a nutritionist and then hence starting my business and my practice and writing my book. But it was very much stemmed from at that time, still as I was putting those jigsaw puzzle pieces back together of my health, still wanting to find out more, to learn more, selfishly to help myself, but then obviously at the same time wanting to help others who were going through similar circumstances. And yeah, that's led me to where I am today, and obviously, you know, setting up my business and my practice and my well-being company and my book, and obviously my practice is all centered around really kind of raising awareness of chronic fatigue and ME, because I just feel like it's one of those things that, I mean, things are starting to improve since the pandemic in terms of kind of long COVID and how that's been done a bit of a PR job for ME/CFS. But I just feel like, you know, more work needs to be done there in terms of raising that awareness and contextualizing the science of what we do know so far, because there is obviously some knowledge we are starting to learn, but it's obviously putting those jigsaw puzzle pieces together and how we apply that to clients in our practice.
Yeah, so I had a similar sort of journey to you, but a little bit earlier. So I had Epstein-Barr when I was 17, so I was at school. So it was that sort of A-level, just done kind of, I started with it at GCSEs. I actually fell asleep in one of my GCSE exams. So yeah, in my physics GCSE, I fell asleep and the teacher kept coming around and just prodding me to wake me up, because I was literally at the start of it. So I ended up with a blood test. I was lucky. My gran worked at the path lab at the hospital. She ran the path lab. So I went down, I think it was like 2 days before my first GCSE, and got a blood test because I wasn't good. And they raced it through for me and it came back as being the glandular fever Epstein-Barr. So yeah, so I literally happened. So thankfully I got to sort of tell school, but I mean, I got through the exams, but the fatigue is, and I think that's the thing that people don't understand. It's, they're like, oh, you get tired with it. It's not tired. It's something way beyond, isn't it? It's this sort of, It's like, I've actually had clients describe it to me in various different ways. I've had, you know, sort of some people have sort of said it's like walking through quicksand.
Yeah, I hear that. Like treacle. Yeah.
That's sort of one of the ways I get, you know, people explaining it to me. And I obviously understand when they say these things, I'm like, yeah, I remember that. I get it. But I think for people who haven't experienced that, understanding that fatigue and the depth of that fatigue.
Yeah.
Can be quite difficult. And I think that can be hard for people, even in terms of, like you said, raising awareness and getting the support, because that fatigue is, it's something else, isn't it? It's not just, you know, I've overexerted, I need to go and have a nap. It's like falling asleep in an exam, which is just so not like me. But you literally cannot stay awake and function, can you?
Yeah. And it is, I can say it's hugely debilitating. I think one of the things there's a lot of outcry about is the naming of ME/CFS, because I mean, obviously, my book's called Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. And the reason it's called that is because, well, in the medical literature, we have ME/CFS. It's kind of more broadly spoken about as such. And, you know, when we say ME means myalgic encephalomyelitis, which if we actually break down that term, my meaning myo, which is a shortened form of muscle. Algic is meaning pain. Encephalo meaning brain. And then you've got the spinal cord, and then itis meaning inflammation. So it's kind of inflammation of the brain and spinal cord. But whilst maybe that's part of the picture in some patients, it's not a pathologically proven explanation for what's happening in the body in this illness. Then you've got CFS. And as I say, the two terms are used kind of interchangeably. And CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, a lot of people say trivializes the actual, how debilitating the illness is, because it is so much more than fatigue. And I say in the book, like, you know, it's like saying somebody with Alzheimer's disease has chronic forgetfulness syndrome. Like, you just wouldn't say it, because it's so debilitating of a condition. And this goes for CFS, because it's not just fatigue. I mean, one of my worst symptoms was brain fog, which, I mean, you could argue is a mental form of fatigue. But like, I literally walked around feeling like I was in a dreamland, like almost like over. And then physically I was fatigued. And then obviously you have a boatload of other symptoms around it, like heart palpitations, digestive issues.
I had those really bad.
Frequent flus and infections, and, you know, just cognitive deficits. But then one of the worst is that, you know, you mentioned the quicksand, is that post-exertional malaise, which is where you are ultimately walking through treacle and you get that classic, I call it payback, where you go past your energy envelope or your energy threshold, and then you're kind of left paying for it thereafter with a crash. And it doesn't always have to be activities that are physical. It could be cognitive. You might have sent an email and then you crash. You might have just maybe walked to the other end of the house or the garden, like really minor kind of activities, and you're crashing. It's not after going for a run or running a marathon. And I think like that's really important to say when we talk about CFS, and just how broad ranging the symptoms are, and as we said, how debilitating.
Yeah, my worst symptoms, even though the fatigue for me was obviously really bad, the worst symptoms for me actually were I got severe neurological pain. So really bad nerve pain and the heart palpitations. So I ended up under endless cardiologists going round in circles because none of them knew what was wrong with me, but they all knew that I'd got these really sort of severe palpitations. So the heart symptoms for me were really bad. They all thought I had a heart condition, and which I don't, but they all thought I did. And the nerve pain. So they were the two, even though the fatigue was really bad for me. And obviously that's kind of in the title of what we say, you know, chronic fatigue. We sort of think that's the main thing. It was really bad. But actually for me, the most debilitating things was the heart palpitations and the nerve pain. That was worse than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's like, because every client I see is like, whilst obviously you can kind of match a certain symptom criteria to fulfill a diagnosis, there is also, when we talk about a syndrome, they don't always necessarily have to have a consistent set between individuals. There might be those key ones, like the hallmark one being post-exertional malaise. But yeah, certainly it's kind of, it can chop and change between individuals in terms of severity of various different symptoms they're experiencing, and also comorbidities that they may have as well, or in addition to.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because it was the Epstein-Barr virus was the trigger for my autoimmune. So that's what set me on that path. So it was my sort of initial trigger. So it's, yeah, it's interesting. So from your perspective, as somebody that has been a patient of this and is also, you know, a practitioner of this, not how is it classified, but how do you think it should be classified? Because there's obviously a lot of debate. We've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but there's been a lot of debate over the years. And patients, I think, do feel very left out in the cold around research into it and knowledge around it and acceptance of it. I think, you know, even sort of from doctors accepting it and things like that. I mean, your patients do feel very like they're left with not very little sort of help. How would you like to see it classified? How would you explain it to a patient, I guess?
So the way that I explain it, it can kind of, again, interchangeably, there's different terms that we can use, from syndrome, disease, illness, condition. The way I always describe it is that, you know, CFS, ME, and as I say, I use CFS because it seems more, less of a mouthful than ME.
Yeah. I think people just know it more as well, don't they? It's sort of, it's commonplace. You know, it's a bit like adrenal fatigue, isn't it? I sort of say adrenal fatigue. Professionally, I would say like HPA axis dysfunction. But if I say that, people don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, we say burnout or adrenal fatigue or, you know, things like that. It's a similar thing, isn't it? Chronic fatigue feels more accessible, I think, in what people understand.
Definitely. And I think it's important to note as well that, like, whilst I think, you know, that they are kind of one in the same, ME, CFS, but it's important to highlight that there are some professionals that think ME is slightly a separate condition. And I think that if we talk about CFS / ME, whatever, you know, more broadly, that when we're looking at kind of root causes and what actually is this illness, it's actually through the research is that the reason that it is so hard for us to kind of classify and identify is because we're maybe looking at this umbrella of different types of subcategories and, you know, root drivers. And that's potentially what makes it so complex to drill down to. So whether you say CFS and ME are two separate things, we might be looking at this whole umbrella and spectrum of root things that are going on and different kind of presentations of that, if that makes sense. So how I define it, I would say CFS / ME or chronic fatigue syndrome, whether we have our qualms about the terminology or whatever else, it's a complex chronic illness, obviously profoundly affects the lives of those that experience it, and it impacts multiple body systems. So it impacts our nervous system, our neuroendocrine system, our immune and our digestive systems. And essentially what we're seeing is that there's evidence that there's a dysregulation happening between these systems, helping to explain the kind of complex spectrum of symptoms that we see in the illness. And then in terms of whether we define it as a syndrome, a disease, an illness, a condition, you know, if we drill down into kind of what those definitions are. So a syndrome refers to like a constellation of signs or symptoms, and that comes from the Greek word syndromus, which essentially means running together. So symptoms in a syndrome might not always be 100% consistent between patients, as we said earlier, and it can also change over time without always having an identifiable cause. Whereas a disease is usually classified as a health condition with a clearly defined biological cause and a consistent change in anatomy, whereas a disorder is often used as a synonym for the word disease. So you've got this whole big umbrella of different terms as well going on here. And so then you've got an illness, which is a bit more of a woolly term, more subjective. It refers to a person's feelings or experience that may or may not occur from a disease. And that could be pain, it could be fatigue, weakness, nausea, which can be influenced by disease factors as well as non-disease factors, maybe beliefs, fears, moods, and your environment. And then you've got a condition, and that's indicative of a person's state of overall health. So it's, again, that's a broad term that it can refer to all of those listed as they just have, but also non-pathological situations like pregnancy and childbirth. So I mean, condition can apply quite widely because it's kind of the status of a person on a spectrum of illness to wellness. But really, I refer to it as chronic illness. Some days I'll refer to it as a syndrome, and some days a dysfunction or a disorder. I mean, I use them all interchangeably, but it's until we can really pinpoint the subgroups, categories, the understanding of how people present, I think it's too early days to kind of say one or the other at this point. But at this moment, very interchangeable.
Yeah, I think, and hopefully that does change in the future. You know, we are getting, not that there was anything good about COVID, but the silver lining, I guess, to a bad situation is that there has been a lot more research into, or there is starting to now be more research into this post-viral syndrome. And generally, I think that the terminology I'm seeing a lot in that research at the moment is post-viral syndrome. They're classifying long COVID as a post-viral syndrome, which I guess you could say the same about around chronic fatigue. And so they're kind of, it's becoming that umbrella again, that's long COVID is going in with that. So the research that's being done is going to benefit, even though it's research, they're doing it into long COVID, it is going to benefit that the chronic fatigue community as well. And it's nice to see that actually finally there is some recognition around that and some research being done.
Yeah, 100%. And I think because, I mean, during the early days, they were kind of, a lot of my clients were getting diagnosed with something called post-COVID ME/CFS. So it was like, again, it's all part of this kind of minefield of just, yeah, loads of different terms, post-viral fatigue, ME, systemic exertion intolerance. You've got, you know, we mentioned adrenal fatigue and things like that. They're all boatloaded under this umbrella. And until we learn more, it makes the defining and the recognition of it very difficult. But like you say, I think COVID has, you know, done a bit of a PR job for really raising awareness of ME/CFS because, you know, people weren't being listened to back then. And it wasn't something this big. And like people saying, actually, no, viruses can really knock you out. And obviously, you know that with ME/CFS, it's not always viral triggers. So I'd probably say like a large percentage of the clients that come to see me are experiencing their ill health as a result of a viral trigger. But for some people, it could be a surgery that they've had. For others, it could be an immunization, just that classic kind of never been well since this event situation.
Yeah.
So yes, in a lot of cases, it can be an infection, but in other cases, it could be slightly different. Or maybe in their childhood, they'd had, say, glandular fever, and then they'd had an adverse childhood experience. And maybe they'd had a lot of stressful, damaging events happen in their early life to throughout their timeline. And then they end up with ME/CFS, but they can't necessarily pinpoint an aha moment of, oh yeah, it was since X. But then you walk back and you understand that actually they've had a lot of these kind of insults on their physiology over time. And that's kind of then led them, you know, made them susceptible to developing ME/CFS.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of functional medicine, isn't it? Is that going, I mean, I'm like you, so I had the Epstein-Barr, the viral infection. So I had that sort of real pinpoint moment with that. But like you said, with the functional medicine, the beauty of what we do with that is taking the full history and walking back and finding, getting the full story, the patient story. And that's what I love about what we do. That's one of my favorite things about what we do is that side of it. I think you get so much information from a person's history. So what about getting a diagnosis? Because I know this is something that a lot of people really struggle with. And like we've said, long COVID obviously has helped a little bit with this. But I guess, what would you advise people to do to advocate for themselves? Because there is going to be a lot of, you know, in any condition like this, there's going to be a lot of advocating for yourself. That's going to be a big part of it. So what can they do if they suspect that they might have, they're listening to this, they've heard what we're talking about, your experience with it, my experience with it, and they think, actually, this might be something that I've got or maybe a loved one has got. What would you advise them to do in terms of trying to get some form of diagnosis, even though we know that that's kind of might be an umbrella sort of diagnosis? But
so, yeah, I think obviously we mentioned it can be a bit of a dustbin diagnosis. It falls similar to IBS in that regard, in terms of it's a cluster of symptoms. You know, maybe your GP might not have a lot of answers in terms of what's going on, but they can then clearly define and rule out anything else that could potentially be causing those symptoms. So obviously we know fatigue is a very broad symptom in and of itself, and that mimics a lot of other different conditions. So if you think about autoimmune diseases, to thyroid disorders, to mental health concerns like depression, for example, you know, fatigue is a big feature in a lot of different conditions. So it's really about, first of all, consulting your GP, I guess explaining that you have knowledge about CFS and ME, and you suspect that actually potentially you might fall in line with some of the key symptoms. I'd say one of the hallmark symptoms to be on the lookout for is post-exertional malaise. So that's that cardinal defining symptom of almost feeling worse after activity. We can call it activity intolerance, if you like. It's not necessarily exercise intolerance. It's more activity intolerance because it doesn't always have to be related to exercise. It could be you've sent an email and so you've done something, whether it's cognitive, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, and that has potentially kind of knocked you for six. So if you're spotting those symptoms, obviously speak with your GP. The important thing to say as well is that, you know, CFS is a diagnosis of exclusion, and that's because we don't currently have a medical test to diagnose CFS, unfortunately. And obviously cases vary, and we know that there's not always a consistent set of symptoms that always match in different individuals or patient groups, but we do have patterns in terms of what we're seeing. And the NHS or the NICE guidance system have set out a criteria to essentially help make that diagnosis, that upon obviously excluding out any other potential and doing the investigations to rule out any other potential cause of the fatigue or the symptoms that you're experiencing, a diagnosis of CFS is made following 3 months of essentially matching the following criteria. So you've got debilitating fatigue that is worsened by activity and is not relieved by rest, post-exertional malaise, which is what I just mentioned, and that's the worsening of symptoms, which can be often delayed in onset by hours or days, and is disproportionate to the activity they've actually done. So it might be something generally mild, like walking to the other end of the garden or walking to the shops, for example, rather than necessarily just going on a run and then feeling tired. And it also has a prolonged recovery time that could last hours, it could last days or even weeks. Then the third kind of symptom criteria is unrefreshing sleep or disturbance in sleep, which could be feeling, you know, exhausted upon waking. So feeling that sleep is not restorative for you, and having kind of an altered sleep pattern or hypersomnia, which is kind of just sleeping a lot throughout the day. And then also the final one there is cognitive difficulties. So often described as brain fog, you know, that kind of classic mental fatigue of maybe you have problems finding the right words or memory recall. You just don't feel quite sharp. You're forgetting things. And that's the diagnostic criteria within the UK. So it's important to highlight as well that the diagnostic criteria can vary across the world. And actually 80% of sufferers can go undiagnosed. So in terms of kind of the population of patients, there's probably a lot of people that are not really going through the medical system and getting a formal diagnosis. Even in my personal circumstances, I actually never had a formal diagnosis, which is shocking, really. I mean, I know sometimes people say that the diagnosis doesn't really stand for much because there's not really a lot of support there within the NHS. But obviously, you know, to have that on your medical record, I think is very important. And actually, when I was writing my book, I went back through my medical transcripts of all the years of medical appointments and everything I was experiencing, and obviously them ruling everything else out. There was no formal diagnosis to say ME/CFS, and I know back then I didn't actually push for it, and I think that was because I was quite terrified reading up online about the doom and gloom of there's no cure, you can never get better. So I almost kind of hid away from it, the reality, and I think I just kind of then focused on the things that I could do to empower myself forwards, and that's obviously luckily what I hung on to, and that's what helped me recover. But just going back to the diagnosis side of things is that, you know, it is important to obviously make sure you're not leaving a stone unturned with regards to ruling out anything else that could be at play. And also persisting with your doctor. If you suspect CFS and maybe they're attributing it to another cause, whether it's psychological, that you kind of think that there's something there, that there's a classic never been well since kind of trigger event, which as I say is very, very common, and that you match that criteria specifically with the post-exertion malaise, then you can always go and get second and third opinions. So do seek around at your GP practice, ring up the receptionist, ask if your doctor has experience working with complex chronic illness like ME, like long COVID, CFS, then and then really think about how you can maximize the benefits of that medical appointment. So book a double appointment with your GP to get the most time, for example, something we only get like 10 minutes, or take a relative or a loved one with you if you find that brain fog's, you know, inhibiting you from being able to really say your piece or take in the information that they're giving back to you. So those are little things of support when it comes to getting a diagnosis.
Yeah, so there's a few things that you were sort of saying there that were ringing. It's when you think back, isn't it? And they're like ringing bells. It's like when you were saying about the cognitive function and not being able to remember your words. And I can remember like being in the kitchen and talking to my mom, and I'd be like, do you want one of those things that, you know, you put in the thing and you pour, and like, and I couldn't get the words for making a cup of tea. Could not find the words to say, do you want a cup of tea? And I would be stood like actioning, pouring a cup of tea into a cup, because the words had gone from my brain. And it's like, when you think back, it's like, it's so bizarre and it's so strange. And trying to explain that to somebody who has never experienced anything like that before, you feel a bit stupid as well.
Like, you feel stupid when it happens as well, because you feel like it's such an obvious thing, but your brain, and it's like the signals aren't connecting. You know what you want to say, but
I knew exactly what I was trying to say.
And then also the stress of that then just kind of makes it even worse.
Makes it worse.
You can't find the words. And you say, oh, it's happening again.
And it is that connection of like your brain is almost not connecting with like with your, you know, with your speech, with your mouth. It's not, the signals are somehow not kind of, I don't know, they're not happening fast enough. It's like there's like this breakdown of connection. But it's the strangest feeling when you're in it, and trying to describe it as well. I think this is the other thing. People need to you know, I love the tips you've given there about with talking to doctors and, you know, taking people in with you and all of these sorts of things. They're great tips. They're all things that I would advocate for. And I think the other one as well is try to, maybe before you go in as well, like write down how you want to describe them. Because sometimes I think when you get in with doctors and you start trying to describe it, because you do feel a little bit silly about some of the symptoms, you sort of almost stumble over your words trying to explain it. You know, you can almost feel a little embarrassed. I think I had a lot of that. I felt quite embarrassed sometimes trying to explain the symptoms. So I think if you can actually write down how you want to explain it before you go in and just take that in with you, just have that prompt, you know, like to help you. Yeah. And to help you to communicate that like really effectively. Because there are, you know, some of the symptoms are like really strange and really bizarre. So I think that can help too. And the other interesting one you mentioned there as well was the delay of that like post-exertional malaise of, you know, can be like hours, days, you know, it's, I think people automatically assume that it's going to be like exercise where, you know, you exercise and you come out of the gym and you're like, oh, your muscles, you can feel you've worked and, you know, like that sort of thing. But it's not necessarily, is it? That delay is a really interesting sort of concept as well that we don't really see with much else other than these sorts of fatigue conditions.
Yeah, and I think that can be a disconnect for a lot of people, because people don't really connect what they've done to the reason why they're feeling like they're feeling. So when I sometimes say to clients, do you experience this post-exertional malaise? Sometimes they don't know, because they just feel flat out all the time. And I go, well, what have you done? And then they've maybe like, you know, taken the kids to school, they've done batch cooking that everyone's dinner, then they've gone and done half a day at work, and then they've paired stuff for the weekend, you know, all kinds of things. And then they've maybe overexert themselves in the gym. You know, these are the ones that are kind of more mobile. But as I say, they're like, oh, I haven't really done that much. But then you don't realize that there's all of these things, even if it's minor things that they're doing at home and they're at home, or things that are kind of building you up or breaking you down in terms of that energy envelope. But as I say, it's understanding how you can connect those dots in terms of the trigger episode or trigger activity and then that fatigue thereafter.
Yeah. I think that's it's really important for people to understand that and to sort of raise awareness about that side of it and that delay. What about exercise, you know, with chronic fatigue? Because we know that obviously from a, you know, muscle standpoint, we have that sort of, you don't use it, you lose it sort of attitude. And it's actually good to do some exercise, even with chronic fatigue syndrome. It is good to exercise. But obviously, a lot of people will just turn around and be like, I'm too tired and I can't do it. So I know we use, you know, there's a lot of theories, but probably one of the really common ones is like the spoon theory and that sort of idea of pacing. You know, is that something that you use in clinic? I know it's things that I've talked to clients about, and learning to pace and planning as well, just planning days. You know, I always talk to them about this, like exactly like you've said, you know, it's things that people maybe don't think are big energy expenditure, but actually they can be. Those smaller things, like just planning out your week so everything's a little bit more spaced out, you're giving yourself time in between. And how do you use, I guess, pacing, and how do you encourage people to exercise, and is there a types of exercise and things like that that you would recommend?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I think, well, maybe I'll start just by, I guess, contextualizing a little bit about the background of the NHS treatments of kind of graded exercise therapy, and then how I incorporate movement and exercise or pacing as well into my practice, and really kind of that level of support. But in the NHS, if you get a diagnosis of ME CFS, this was kind of in the history of CFS and ME, historically, they would recommend something called graded exercise therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and maybe potentially medications such as anything to kind of help you with sleep, for example, or low mood, but not really necessarily targeting the overall arching complaints that you're experiencing. So with graded exercise therapy, that's a structured exercise program, and it aims to gradually increase physical activity, usually involving exercises that increase heart rate. So things like walking, things like swimming. And once the activity levels that you're doing have been established, the healthcare professional that's doing Get With You will work to set goals to increase the intensity and the duration of the exercise going forward. And the interesting thing about that is it happens irrespective of patient feedback. So if that person had been complaining that, you know, maybe they've been told to set, maybe their health professional set a goal for them to continuously walk an extra mile every day or every week, for example, but they're saying, actually, no, I'm feeling worse, it still would enforce those goals and those targets, regardless of that feedback. So the therapy basically came around because of a PACE trial, which was the trial by the UK Medical Research Council back in 2011. Basically, it was one of the largest randomized controlled trials on ME CFS. It looked at graded exercise therapy and also CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is obviously a talking therapy to support patients mentally. And it suggested that a full recovery from CFS was possible following those interventions. And that's where the NHS justified that CBT and GET was almost a way to quote unquote cure ME CFS, because it was actually regarded as a curative therapy. But if you think about it, this idea of graded exercise therapy is almost thinking about ME CFS as though people's problems are resulting from deconditioning. They're not thinking the right thoughts. So they need CBT so that they can get out of those unhelpful thinking patterns. And they also need to move their bodies more, because actually they're tired because they're not really that active. So this puts, you know, a whole outcry on the patient group, and obviously in terms of their response to that and how that's framed. But actually there was a lot of outcry from not only the patients, but researchers, clinicians, CFS charities, because of how they were starting to see that patients were being made worse from the graded exercise therapy. And I think that's because of this element of the physical activity being increased regardless of how the patient is feeling. So back in 2021, as a result of all of this kind of criticism, the NHS removed graded exercise therapy. And then they also reframed the CBT as almost a management for the kind of psychological effects of having a chronic illness versus, okay, this is a curative tool. As I say, GET was scrapped, and then CBT was reframed as almost a management tool. You know, we've got to think about how exercise, especially in the early stages of ME CFS, has to be very, very carefully monitored. And anybody that's in that crash stage of the illness, which is essentially when the illness first hits, maybe you've just come out of the initial stages of potentially an infection, if that's kind of your precipitating trigger, is thinking about very, very low and slow when it comes to movement. And it's important to say, you know, it's not to say don't move your body at all, because obviously we can get problems with deconditioning if somebody's on bed rest, even if it's just gentle limb movements or stretching or gently moving about the house, if that is a possibility for you. But really thinking about how we can carefully grade activity based on the stage of recovery somebody is at within their journey. So obviously that's all individualized. And so I talk about something called grading, which is essentially, you think of it almost like a staircase rather than a slope. So it's kind of like when the person is at a stage with, where they're able to start to increase activity without having this boom and bust effect of the kind of symptoms occurring as a result of the activity that you're doing, and being able to maintain that activity for 2 weeks, let's say, and then being able to gently grade up again, maintain, and then gently grade up again and maintain. And obviously that looks different on everybody. And so when we talk about pacing, what I always say to clients is try and find your baseline. Your baseline is the level of activity, and that's physical, mental, or both, that you can comfortably manage on at least 3 or 4 consecutive days without experiencing symptoms as a result. So that's kind of where you're finding that groove of not being on that boom and bust effect, kind of that wham bam of one day you're up, next day you're down, and just kind of having tripping yourself up almost after doing anything. Form of activity. And it often begins as less than you'd imagine, and it can be almost a frustrating place to be, because you feel like, oh, actually I can't really do a lot, what, I've got to hang back.
I had that a lot. I had so much frustration at how slow I had to build things up, but I learned that if I pushed too much through, which was through frustrated, which was, it was my own fault because I wanted to do more, and I'm not good at holding myself back, but the more I did that, the more I pushed myself, I realized actually that I ended up out of the game, out of being able to progress and build that for longer. And actually I got there quicker by doing it low and slow and building up frustratingly slowly. But that actually got me there quicker in the end than trying to push myself. But it is frustrating. I think as a patient, it can be really difficult to pull yourself back.
Yeah. And especially if you have that kind of A-type achiever mentality, where sometimes our self-esteem is connected to our achievement and what we actually do. Yeah. You know, there's that tendency on a good day to just seize the day and do everything that actually yesterday you couldn't do. So it's like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the shops. I'm going to go for a jog if I can do that. I'm going to go see my friends, and I'm going to go for that night out. And then you're just left paying for it thereafter. And I think it's incredibly frustrating. And one of the things I say to clients is it is a process of trial and error. And I'd say with pacing, it's more of an art than a science. It's about, you only know your body better than anybody. You know exactly how activity is making you feel. So it's about finding that baseline. And as I say, frustratingly, doing less. So if that's your baseline, is your capacity, if you think of it as that, that's your 100% energy remit and energy envelope. And then I always recommend something called the 75% rule, which is almost kind of dropping that back by 25%. So you're actually, if you think of your energy like a bank balance, if you had £10 to spend every day, we don't want to go overdrawn and spend 11. We don't want to spend bang on 10. We actually want to spend £7.50. So we've got £2.50 left for a rainy day. And it's the same thing with this kind of 75% rule. So even though it's a very frustrating, you've almost got to work on that mentality of, okay, this is being reframed as self-care. I'm hanging back. You're kind of dealing with the kind of emotional guilt side of things of not doing a lot, but you're also kind of thinking, actually, this is the, I'm in the long game here, focusing on the long term, and really allowing that as a buffer to allow your energy to recalibrate and allow those, your nervous system to kind of dampen down and just calm down and put it into that parasympathetic. And that's where, as you start to see energy coming back in, that's where you start to kind of approach, because when you get out of the crash stage, you enter into this wired and tired stage. And the wired and tired is where energy is coming back in, but it's going straight to the nervous system. So you're kind of just feeling, as I say, that wham, bam, of boom and bust. So you're getting energy, but it's going in the wrong direction. And so doing the 75% rule is a great way to kind of pace. And then as you're starting to see the energy coming back in, as you approach this restoration stage, is when we start to then grade up, see how you do. Grade up, see how you do. And if you are noticing post-exertion malaise throughout that period, you drop back again, you keep following the same principle of 75% and then grade and 75%. But one thing that can be really helpful with that is I always ask clients to do an activity diary. So if you list just during your kind of weekly or daily routine, the typical activities that you're doing, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, or all three, and just list like what's energy draining, what's energy building, and what's energy neutral. And that can change because it's context dependent, but it really helps you to build up a picture of, okay, what is it about that task that made it energy draining for me? Was it because symptoms were flaring that day? Was it the previous task that I did because I actually did two things that were energy draining and then maybe I did something else that was energy draining. So it's having this compound effect. Is it because I'm just in a bad mood that day, which is also perfectly valid? Is it because I'm hormonal? And all of those things can help us to, and when I do sessions on pacing with clients, it's helping us to understand how we can kind of wax and wane the routine and almost incorporate scheduled rest buffers in so that we are finding that balance between activity and rest.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And what about sleep? Because obviously this comes into, you know, this energy picture that we're talking about in terms of how much you can do. We know that sometimes people with CFS don't necessarily have great sleep. Are you a promoter of power naps and things like that? Because I know for me personally, when I mean, I do promote them for people if they need them, but as the patient, if I'm going back to when I was the patient, I was not good at taking them. Sometimes I had no choice. So I literally just fell asleep. But I think because of that, and this is a little bit probably of a type A personality thing, but because I felt like I was just falling asleep sometimes and I couldn't do things and that really annoyed me, I then didn't then want to just actively take a power nap, which actually probably would have been better. I probably would have kept going for longer through the day if I had.
Yeah.
But the type A personality and myself wouldn't let me do that. And I had to really kind of teach myself, actually. I had to kind of almost rewire the way that I thought about it. And see it as exactly as you've just said, as a self-care thing. It is something like that. So do you, you know, how do you sort of talk to patients about naps? Is that something that you would promote them doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, well, obviously in CFS, it's common for sleep cycles to be disrupted anyway because of, you know, a lot of clients or patients have to rely on sleeping during the day just to get by. So that's kind of those that are in the kind of more severe stages. And obviously a lot of people take naps just to either kind of get over a crash or because their brain fog symptoms are maybe too strong during the day and it just helps them recover from that post-exertional malaise or the exacerbation of symptoms. But I definitely find naps to be restorative for CFS patients only if they're applied appropriately, because it's about experimenting what works best for you as an individual and, you know, really considering naps in the context of how they make you feel. So what is the purpose of the nap based on their length, their frequency and the time of day that you take them, as well as obviously how well that person is sleeping at night. So for example, if you find that daytime napping makes it harder to fall asleep at night, then you know, try avoid having them at least 6 hours before you normally go to bed. And obviously naps that are longer than, say, 30 minutes can increase that risk of sleep grogginess when you wake up, which then can obviously impact your fatigue for the rest of the day. So trying to keep them shorter or no longer than 30 minutes can help with feeling unmotivated or feeling fatigued afterwards. And if you're somebody that requires multiple daytime naps, it's trying to reduce the number that you take over time, perhaps down to just one nap. And obviously that's something that has to be done, you know, gently and sensibly with each individual, just so that as a result that can really help to support their circadian rhythm. Because if somebody's relying on a lot of daytime naps just to get through, chances are they're not sleeping at night. So it's really how can we reduce that down so that they can then start to sleep at night. But the best way to, you know, talk to clients about napping if they're kind of resistant, you know, it potentially might be a benefit to them, sounds like maybe you back in the early days, is that, you know, it's thinking about reframing the naps and giving yourself permission to rest and reframing those naps as a pathway to productivity. Because actually, you getting your head down for 30 minutes, I mean, how many people spend 30 minutes scrolling through their phone? 30 minutes with your eyes closed and just having that nap can actually be that pathway to productivity that actually, because sometimes if we're not feeling great anyway, we procrastinate and we put off things during our day. So if you procrastinate for 30 minutes, actually that nap would be the thing that kind of sees you through the afternoon, or sees you through the rest of the day. So I think there's a lot of work that I try to do with clients around mindset and guilt, because there's sometimes, you know, a lot going on there in terms of, you know, not feeling capable or not feeling able. And one thing I say to clients that really helps with reframing where they're at, and this is useful for pacing as well, is it's not that your capability has changed or diminished, it's that your capacity has slightly stretched. So you are still capable of doing all the things that you used to do, that, you know, especially the things that maybe they would naturally associate with their self-esteem, which really that's, you know, where we need to do that inner work to kind of uncover a little bit more. But to really kind of say you are capable of those things. It's just that right now the capacity is slightly stretched and diminished, and what will work, it's not going to be like that forever, but we're going to work to get that back and we're building that back. But we need to kind of think less is more for the time being, if that makes sense. And giving yourself and have those rest naps and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a really great way. I wish, you know, going back, because obviously, I mean, you know, we're going back to when I was like at school. So before I'd sort of studied any of this, and I wish somebody back then had framed it to me in that way. But there was obviously less of that around at that time. And thankfully, there is more people talking about it in that way in this day and age. We could still do with more, but it is growing. And somebody saying it to me in that way back then, I think would have been hugely beneficial.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Back then.
So let's look at diet. And this is, we could literally do a whole episode on diet for CFS, because there's so much that we could talk about. But do you have like some top tips? Is there like, you know, maybe three things or however many? Is there some, a few top tips that you would sort of say to people around diet if they think that this is what they've got? Try, you know, implement these things first and give that the foundational steps a go.
Yeah. So when I first sit down with a client, I'd always ask them to complete a 7-day food diary. And I know what you eat from week to week can change, but it really gives us a bit of a blueprint of what you're kind of naturally consuming or routinely consuming. And from there, it's helpful to kind of have that as a food and symptom diary. So we can ascertain if there are any specific foods that trigger symptoms. So we know that with kind of the symptoms of CFS, we do tend to see food intolerance as a big part of that. You know, people saying, actually, I ate this and it made me feel worse, made the brain fog worse, made me feel more fatigued, of course, the digestive issues I'm experiencing. So trying to kind of isolate. So an elimination diets can be useful from that perspective. You know, you kind of tend to see the low-hanging fruits of kind of gluten and dairy being eliminated if they cause people concern, and especially if there's autoimmunity in the mix with kind of the gluten. But I try not to be super totalitarian about that, because obviously we still don't have enough data at this point in time to kind of say yay or nay to a specific diet. But I think if we follow the principles of removing the low-hanging fruits of, as you say, the classic kind of food triggers that could be driving food intolerance, for a moment in time, if they're adding to the symptom load, and then working on reducing things like ultra processed foods, which, you know, classically we kind of really want to kind of lower inflammation. So thinking about an anti-inflammatory diet, high sugar foods, alcohol, especially if somebody's in the crux of that illness, and then also kind of heavy caffeine intake, if that is also potentially driving that nervous system dysregulation. But yeah, really, there's a no one size fits all. So it's kind of thinking of those common food intolerance drivers. Things like histamine can also be part of the picture. People suffering with maybe MCAS as part of that, and that they're noticing that they're kind of being triggered by things like tomatoes, avocados, or fermented foods. I try to do like a 5-R approach with a lot of clients, of kind of we remove, we work on replacing, working on the gut, the terrain, re-inoculating, repairing the gut lining, and then working on rebalancing. As well as part of that, I'm a big fan of kind of reintroducing. So trying to, you know, things that hurt you before may not hurt you now. And I think that's also really important to remember, because sometimes people are stuck on a very, very strict diet for years and years and it's miserable. And I know, because I've had my own experiences with, you know, very strict elimination diet, and it really wrecked my relationship with food. So I'd say take those principles that work with the individual, because it's not just, I'd say it's part of the jigsaw puzzle, but it's not the whole piece. But I think the key facets there is thinking about blood sugar balancing as well, and really thinking about reducing inflammation as much as possible. So when I talk to clients about blood sugar balance, you know, I always ask them, how does a meal make you feel energy-wise? Does it make you feel better? Like, does it improve your energy, or does it make your energy worse? If it makes your energy better, chances are you're on the hypoglycemic spectrum. If it makes it worse, maybe hyperglycemic. So it's really helpful for understanding meal spacing, how somebody's eating across the day in that rhythm. Are they grazing a lot, for example? And how can we think about balanced plates? So, you know, really incorporating half of your plate with non-starchy vegetables, lots of diversity, lots of color and fiber. And then thinking about like a palm-sized serving of lean protein. If you eat animal products, a fistful of complex carbs, and then 1 to 2 thumb-sized serves of healthy fats, for example. And obviously, if you're vegan or vegetarian, making half of your plate with the non-starchy veg, and then the other half your plant-based proteins or your high-quality eggs and dairy, for example. But it's really about, you know, focusing on those, the blood sugar balancing element, trying to incorporate the anti-inflammatory diet as much as possible, of really thinking about things like ginger, turmeric, lots of fiber, because that's going to have an anti-inflammatory effect, omega-3s, and also little things that can help up level in terms of packing in nutrient density. So just, I would say, like, try and have a cup of green leafy veg each day, whether you're packing that into your smoothie and making sure that you're rotating that around, because a diverse diet is a really healthy diet. Really great way to pack in things like magnesium, B vitamins, folate, iron, for example. It's one of those things that no one size fits all, but if we focus on those principles, how people are eating is also really important too. But thinking as well, what is achievable? Because if clients got no energy, they're also not going to be able to cook. So how can we incorporate things that are, again, low hanging fruits? And it's not about doing all of that overnight. You know, those are kind of layers of how we work with somebody, but also thinking about their relationship with food, because if they're, everybody knows what a healthy diet looks like, but it would say, how are you going to get there? So it's thinking about addressing those mindset obstacles and blocks that are impeding the ability to get.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And you know, obviously what we do is personalized medicine. It is about tailoring it to each individual, but I think there are steps that people can take and start thinking about. And like you say, I've got so many people come to me and they're like, I'm too tired to cook. We have to, as practitioners as well, we have to work around a person's capabilities at that time. And that's not to say that they won't get back to being, well, I've worked with people where they've been like, I can't cook in an evening, I'm just too tired to cook in an evening. We rework their sort of when they're going to do the cooking, and we find them some meals that they can eat that require very little cooking for the evening and things like that. But that doesn't mean we don't get them back to a point where actually, you know, I've worked with clients before where they end up coming back and they're like, I love cooking now in the evening. You know, they love cooking their meals when they get home. It's a big part of their day. And we've built a really good relationship around food with that. And they actually really enjoy it. And they've now got the energy to do it. And so it's not about not being able to get back there. I think exactly as you've just said, it's layering those things on top of each other slowly, isn't it? And helping people.
And that's part of the pacing, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Helping people just get back there. And I think as well, just being kind to yourself and sort of saying, like, it's okay that at the moment I'm too tired to cook in the evening. And, you know, I'll find another way around this, and then build on it slowly and get back there. Yeah. And I think that's a really big part of the diet, because, you know, the cooking does take, as you were talking about with that, you know, the energy of that pacing and you know, grading and everything, it's, you know, cooking, is really draining. It is a big part of the problem.
Yeah, totally. And obviously, like, things that can help there is, you've seen listing help if you're lucky enough to live with somebody that can help you. Batch cooking is fantastic, because if you've got things, you're making friends with your freezer and having things that you can put in your freezer that are there for a rainy day, or even just things that, like, are very easy to kind of whip up, like soups that you can just, as I say, make in batches and have in the fridge. But yeah, there are, obviously, it's a conversation, isn't it? And I think it's thinking about where somebody is based on their journey at that moment in time, and what we can do to make that more flexible and more easy for them.
Yeah, I talk to people a lot about as well, like, slow cookers and things like this, that, you know, maybe seen as a little bit old school now. It's like sort of an older way of how things used to be done.
What about great barriers now, isn't
it? Yeah, but for somebody who actually wants to home cook and enjoys it and has the capacity to do it earlier in the day, but maybe doesn't have the capacity to do it in the evening, actually, like, you know, having a slow cooker and doing a slow cooker where you get to the evening and it's been cooking all day and it's there, and you've got that lovely home cooked meal that you're going to really enjoy, but you haven't had to put the energy into it later in the day. That's something that I found a lot of clients have actually really pleased. Like, oh gosh, I remember when, like, you know, my mom had a slow cooker and all of this. It can actually be a really good thing to bring back. And it's, again, not to say that you have to do it that way forever, but it's just, it can be something. You know, if they've got that energy earlier in the day, which I tend to find with clients, some of them do, you know, that can be another nice way of it's a bit like batch cooking, isn't it? It's that sort of, you're pre-prepping, aren't you? You're sort of doing the harder work earlier on.
Yeah, or even buying the kind of pre-chopped vegetables that you get in, like, supermarkets, so that instead of having to spend time chopping and peeling, which I think puts a lot of people off, especially if you're fatigued, you know, having that step already done as a convenience is great, because you can bang that in your slow cooker. Or one thing I always am a big fan of advising to clients is tray bake.
Yes.
So literally, you know, get your pre-chopped vegetables from a packet. If that's easier for you, that's more convenient, do it. Add it all onto a baking tray, drizzle some olive oil, some herbs de Provence, some salt, some pepper, then maybe a salmon fillet goes aside on the side, maybe some sweet potato, bang it in, then you've got your balanced plate. You know, so that's kind of all done. And that is a great one to batch cook. But yeah, to kind of do the same and add that into a slow cooker, or if you're doing stir fry with packet of your stir fry mix, you know, those are kind of very easy ones that if you're fatigued, kind of tick the box and pretty healthy to do.
So. Yeah, I think that's it. And it's just finding ways of staying healthy, isn't it? Without having the huge energy expenditure. That's really important. What about toxin load? Because I see a lot of this in clinic, particularly with autoimmune and CF. I work with a lot of autoimmune patients, a lot of thyroid, a lot of chronic fatigue. So all of these sort of, I always say now, I sort of work with all of those conditions that cause fatigue, basically, because autoimmune usually have got fatigue. Thyroid patients usually fatigue, chronic fatigue. Toxins, I found, can be quite a big root cause. I'm seeing a lot, actually, at the moment, a lot of mold, particularly since COVID. There's been a lot of mycotoxins coming up. But, you know, there's so many different toxins. But are toxins something that you see a lot with clients?
It tends to be the case that more of my clients that come to see me, it's a classic, never been well since, most often due to an infection. But what can happen is we can start to see toxicity load as part of the picture. So we know that in terms of CFS, toxicity can be a trigger and a driver of what's going on in terms of symptoms. So sometimes it's that insidious kind of drip effect. Maybe they've had an exposure and they've not even known it. And then maybe they've kind of become unwell as a result of the infection, but then they've had all of these other things, because obviously we know that toxins like heavy metals or organophosphates and mold, for example, they can really impede the functioning of the mitochondria. So yeah, it's definitely part of a picture. And, you know, things like if I'm testing, for example, like organic acids tests, we can see things that maybe are impeding, like heavy metals that could be impeding that. And sometimes we see kind of like petrochemical exposure on tests. I don't test as much for the kind of heavy metals and molds unless I feel that there's a specific situation, like, you know, kind of sick building syndrome. Yes. Where somebody moved into a home that's infested with mold, and then I think, okay, I think I've got some exposure here. And the reason only being is because when I'm doing testing, it's trying to think of what's the best bang for somebody's buck. So if they really want to do the toxicity testing, then I think we definitely do it. And we can obviously work on protocols to support the detox. But generally, when somebody comes to see me, I'll focus more on the GI effects, for example, like the stool tests, the hormonal, I do organic acids, and maybe I'll do an adrenal stress profile, because those tend to be the ones that I find are enlightening in terms of a bit more of a 360 overview in terms of what's going on in terms of their systems. Whereas the toxicity is definitely part of the picture, but it's just only if I find that there's a high risk, if that makes sense. Depends on the client's budget. So if they want to go and do those tests, I'm always mindful, because I know these tests, and then you're putting interventions, it just adds, doesn't it? So it's those sorts of things.
Yeah, it does. No, I'm the same. It's when you see that picture that instantly makes you kind of the light bulb goes off in your head, and you sort of think, oh, mold. You know, there's like I, you know, I have it where I had a client recently who was like feeling like pretty sick at home, like quite poorly. And she actually went on holiday, and she was like, oh, I felt a lot better when I was on holiday. And then within like a few days of being home, like she felt a lot more fatigued again. And I was like, that for me then is like, we'd done the sort of, you know, the gut testing and adrenals and all of this. And that for me was then like, okay, there's this indication here that actually there might be something that we tested. Yeah. She actually had, I think she had, there was three or four molds in her in her test that came back. Yeah, so that, but it is exactly as you're saying. It's if there's that thing, isn't it, that makes you, as a practitioner, oh, you know, there's something else going on here that maybe we're missing as part of the picture, and it's then something to add in as an extra part.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when I was kind of doing my research for the book, in terms of kind of toxic exposures, classically, a lot of farmers would become unwell with ME/CFS due to the sheep dips. Uh-huh. So they put their sheep in pesticides kind of to, you know, protect them against anything. And they weren't wearing protective clothing. So as a result, they were getting exposure to all these organophosphates. And then that was triggering ME/CFS. So they were starting to see it in, you know, these communities of farmers as a result of sheep dips. But yeah, there's obviously other things like having a lot of high heavy metal fish, or if they've maybe had amalgam fillings and potentially there could be some exposure there. Or like you say, they've moved in somewhere and they're like, okay, moved in here and I've never been well since, right?
Yeah.
That same sort of thing. But yeah, I don't always, as I say, test for those as regularly, but I do if somebody is really insistent or if I'm really insistent that that's something that we need to address, because it definitely, it's going to impede your cellular health. It's going to impede your functioning of your mitochondria and producing ATP. And it's going to potentially drive that boom and bust effect in terms of that classic symptom that we're seeing.
You mentioned when we were talking about the food, you mentioned about, you know, if you're lucky enough to have somebody who can maybe cook for you, and, you know, and that's sort of part of this support network picture, which I think is really important for good patients with sort of chronic fatigue, any of these sort of chronic illnesses. It is important to have some form of support network. And I think one of the hardest things that I found to hear when, you know, when I was, you know, going back to me being the patient again, rather than the practitioner, you know, a lot of the time you hear that sort of like, oh, you know, you don't look ill. You know, I know people are saying, like, I knew that people, I didn't take offense because I knew people were meaning it in a complimentary way of, you know, oh, you look good, you look okay, you know, you know, and it's it, they were meaning it, yeah, in a nice, yeah, way. Yeah, but yeah, it can sometimes, when you're in the moment, it can sometimes feel a little bit like people are not believing you, or you're, you know, there's that sort of, and I think a lot of that probably comes from inside you and how you feel with, you know, maybe not being heard. And you know, and patients also tell me that they've heard people sort of say, oh, you know, they're just lazy, or maybe they're just depressed, or, you know, these different things that they sort of hear with typically with these sort of chronic fatigue things. How important do you think it is? I know for me, it was super important. How important do you think it is for patients to have like a positive support network around them with chronic fatigue? And, you know, what's your advice? Because I always say to people, you know, with relationships, this is, you know, whether it's autoimmune or chronic fatigue, I always sort of say relationships are really important, and they can be hugely beneficial in your life. They can also be hugely toxic in your life. You know, it can be one extreme or the other. And you have got to learn, haven't you, to surround yourself with the positivity, the positive people, the people who are actually supporting you and helping you. And you maybe do need to remove somebody if they are more, you know, more of that toxic relationship, which isn't going to do you any good. But how important do you see that support network as for people?
Yeah, I think it's really vital, especially if somebody's going through CFS, because it is one of those, I mean, there's a lot of stigma is still kind of there, isn't it, in terms of what people, how people understand it, how people see it. And I do think that's getting better, they say, thankfully, due to the pandemic, but it's still not quite there. And even the term, as we said earlier, is trivializing it slightly. Oh, chronic fatigue syndrome, isn't that just when you feel tired all the time? And, you know, it really kind of, it's an injustice to how debilitating it is. And because as well, like you were saying, when people say, oh, you don't look poorly, I actually had somebody say, you know, my scenario where I think it was actually a friend, and I lost friends as a result of my illness. I very much internalized that because of my illness, because of the way that I was dealing with it, because I wasn't able to go out and maybe party like I used to. And I was, you know, I was not drinking. I was in a very healthy lifestyle and doing all these things, which as a youngster, maybe as a 19-year-old, your friends don't really understand. They're like, well, you look okay. And then when I obviously used the words like ME/CFS, one of them said like, oh, well, you don't have it, you're not in a wheelchair. So that really triggered me and really upset me, because again, and that's one of the things I like to advocate, is to say, actually, it's a spectrum disorder. It can affect people on a multitude of levels. There's 25% of the patient population who are housebound, bedbound, which, you know, is very, very sad. And obviously for those, a support network is vital, because some of them need full-time care. Whereas I was more mild to moderate. So, and maybe like you, you know, we were mobile, so we were able to go out the house, but we felt crap. And maybe we went out the house, but we were paying for it later. It's always something I still kind of wrestle with, really. But I think like the more I learn about this illness and realize how there's a lot of complexities to it, and there's a lot of, you know, still such a lack of awareness. I think us doing this podcast today is great, because we're obviously helping to advocate for this community. It only helps to validate that a bit more in terms of actually, and I think now with the awareness that's coming out around mental health, and you don't have to look unwell to be unwell. Yeah. You know, you don't have to have a bandage on or a broken leg or be in a wheelchair to be ill. And it doesn't mean you're making it up. Like, especially ME/CFS, it's a spectrum disorder. And as I say, you can be mild, you can be moderate, you can be severe. And even if you're mild or moderate, it still can be hugely debilitating. So yeah, going back to support, I think having a network of people around you that support you. And obviously in my journey, it was a time for me to kind of reassess friendships, because I almost kind of forced into it through people's comments, or I guess lack of support in a certain way that which I wanted. And maybe it just kind of, we were on different paths. So I was on maybe a healing path and they were just living their youth. Maybe that was what I was jealous of, that because I wanted to do those things and get involved. But at that point, see, my capacity was changed, not my capability. So I think it does force you to evaluate who's around you. But I think in a way, it almost kind of gives you that ability to then be grateful for who is around you and focus on the good side of it. And even if it's having, you know, two friends, I think quality over quantity, or like just somebody there that's got your back, one person that you can speak to, share your story, and somebody that really gets it. And I often get asked about, you know, social media and community and things like that for people who are suffering. And I think social media is a bit of a chicken and egg when it comes to CFS recovery and kind of having a community. I think it's brilliant that people can share their experiences of how they're getting on with others and they can form that network. And that's something we never had years ago. So I think there's a real benefit in that. For a lot of people, they'd say, you know, it's a real lifeline. But it's also important to highlight the negatives of it, because we can so often compare and contrast our recovery journeys to others, even the people that are worse off or better off. Like, you might think, okay, well, they're better off than me, so I don't know if I'll make a full recovery because I'm not them. And I often ask clients, you know, like, do you believe recovery from CFS is possible? And sometimes they'll say yes. And then I'll go, but do you believe you can recover? And then I'll go, no. So it's like, okay, how do we unpack that? But yeah, so sometimes the comparisons tends to get thrown into the mix, and people then start to compare how somebody else has done it, and then they think they're doing it wrong, and people try very hard to recover through following what somebody online who's maybe not a qualified health professional has done, and then that throws a lot of concerns as well. So as I say, chicken and egg, but very good for getting a bit of support network. But I think it's important to make friends in the real world and obviously have a family member or just one person that's kind of your solid who you can really rely on.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Let's talk a little bit about the work that you do now. You've got Ardere, which is your sort of wellness company. So tell us a little bit about that and about the clinic work that you do as well.
Ardere is a holistic wellbeing company. It's founded by myself and my sister, also called Nicole. Ardere is it's a Latin translation of the word glow. So it's our interpretation of how you feel when you're healthy, you're happy, you glow. We're all about advocating and empowering kind of education in terms of nutrition and lifestyle medicine, how people can really support themselves if they are struggling with their health in any way, whether that's, you know, we work with obviously any CFS, long COVID cases, but we also work with gut health issues, autoimmunity, to kind of women's hormonal health and weight loss, but also kind of disordered relationships with food as well. So a real boatload of complaints of, you know, how people can understand that can really be empowered to make changes. And there's a lot we can do naturally to support ourselves. So we have a kind of clinical practice, a team of nutritionists. We also have psychologists as well, who is brilliant. And obviously we do different sessions with those and different packages that can support people individually. So we have like one package which works on obviously CFS. It's kind of our recovery roadmap. And that's like a 12-week program where we focus on a lot of what we kind of talked about today. So, you know, we do the root drivers in terms of kind of understanding if there's a need to perform any labs or testing, work on the nutrition, work on identifying any kind of dysregulations at play, but then also covering key elements like pacing, working on mindset and recovery, because we know that the mind-body connection is also really important to address when it comes to recovery, working on sleep, detoxification, your environment. So we have the clinic side of our business, and then we also have our product side. So we have self-care product and retail, 100% natural wax and therapy candles, and we're soon going to be branching into natural skincare as well.
Oh, lovely.
So that's kind of a little bit about us.
Ah, yeah, that's exciting. That would be great to see when that's ready.
That's a little bit about us. And obviously the book is obviously contextualizing a little bit about any CFS as a topic, the science of what we know so far. And I've tried to make it as easy to understand as possible for those who really, obviously, if their energy is particularly taxed, you know, really wanted to kind of understand. Because it is complex, but there's also a lot we can kind of understand as we break it down into the different systems that are affected. So I try to make that as easy to interpret as possible. And then we go through the how-tos, the nutritional lifestyle strategies based on personal case studies and testimonials and things like that. So it's kind of a hybrid of self-help, science and how-to, if you like.
Yeah, it's a great read, the book. I'd highly recommend anybody out there who is struggling with chronic fatigue or knows somebody even that is struggling with chronic fatigue and wants to understand it as part of that support network. It would equally be beneficial for them to have a read of the book, but it's a brilliant read. So definitely recommend that. We'll link Ardere, we'll link your website, we'll link the book as well, all below the episode and a way for people to contact you so they can get in touch if they want. But it's been really great to talk to you today. Because I love, you know, I think a lot of what we do is a very similar. We work in a very similar way, which is really, it's always really nice when you get these conversations where it really feels like that, and promoting those same things to people around sort of raising awareness around this illness and how people can recover from it. Because you really can. And I think it's really important to put that message out there to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is it's working on those kind of belief blocks for people, but really understanding kind of, you know, it can sometimes be that snakes and ladders effect of that up and down, but health is fluid. And, you know, I would say to clients, so recovery is absolutely possible. And it's focusing sometimes on inspiring yourself forwards, but always measuring yourself backwards. So focusing on the evidence of what you built so far, like where you were yesterday, you maybe wouldn't have imagined 2 weeks ago or a month ago, for example. So it's really about understanding that. And that's a key part of what we do in clinic. So
thank you so much for giving us your time today and coming on, joining me on the podcast. It's been really great to have a conversation with you.
It's been lovely to speak to you. So thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Good Health Podcast. Do share the episode with anyone who you think it may benefit or who may enjoy it. And help me spread the word by rating the episode or leaving a review. If you want more, you can find other episodes in the series on your podcast app or sign up to my free newsletter. Not only will you get information on new episodes launching, but we cover lots of health topics with the Ask Nicole section where you can send in your questions, my favorite recipes, my favorite products, tips and tricks to help you on the road to good health, and much more. You can sign up free of charge at nicolegoodhealth.com/newsletter. Also linked below. I hope you have a lovely week. Don't forget to hit subscribe and I'll see you next time.